We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. Hello, friends. We only have three more episodes of Australian True Crime for 2019. Can you believe it? Unless, of course, you are a patron, in which case you'll still get a brand new episode every week over the Christmas break. I'm also in the process of setting up a Discord account. You may have read about Discord in terms of adults stalking children. That's where I read about it, but it turns out you can do other things with it as well. The good news is that my son Louis is actually setting up my Discord account. Of course, the troubling news is that Louis knows how to set up Discord accounts. It's these dumb games they play. You just gotta be on it. You gotta know what they're doing all the time and have sneaky looks at their phones when they're in the bath. Please do not tell Louis I said that. Anyway, we're going to have a community on Discord for creative people who want help with their own podcasts and writing and stuff. It's going to be called the Australian True Crime Creative Community. So keep an eye out for that. And when I told Louis it was going to be called the Australian True Crime Creative Community, he snorted and rolled his eyes, which I guess means he loves it and thinks it's super cool. Thank you to the following new patrons, John McEnroe. Oh no, sorry, McEncrow. I did think it was the tennis super brat from the 80s. But John McEncrow, I'm sure you're terrific as well and probably have a much better emotional filter than the tennis guy. Grant W, Fiona Brocks, you know, oh, got an email. Fiona Brocks, you know I love those names. Nikki Moffat DeVries. Have I said that before? Maybe I just dreamed it because it's so great. Christine Hollard, that's got a D and a T at the end, Hollard. Gillian Chamberlain, Georgia Vallis, Matthew Hurley, Angela Dane, love that. Janine, just Janine. Kevin Park, Joanne Nichols, Melinda Mitzi. Oh, that's a good name. We had a cat called Mitzi. She was a mole. She used to shit in the shower when she was angry, which was often. Lisa Jackman. I'm assuming you don't do that, Melinda Mitzi. Dee Ohms. Ingrid Ullman. God, how good are your names? Ray Carl. Lainey McGorman, Sarah Allen, and she says, I wish my name was more exciting for you, Michelle. Hey, Sarah. Come on, girl. Sarah Allen's terrific. Probably in a different country, they'd be going, oh, wow, check this name out. Sarah Allen. Rachel Chambers. Susan. Tash. They've got to be friends, haven't they? Susan and Tash. Lisa Henderson. Oh, my God. This. Solveig Uber. Oh, name envy. Helen Sutton, Bridget O'Grady, Amanda, Julie Chick. Is that your real name, Julie Chick? Or is it Julie Chick? Sheridan Cox. Does she? Mark Hussey. Jess Mastring... Hang on. Jess Mastrangioli. Nice. Alicia Wiley. Deb Ryman. Leonie Player. Kinsley Weir. Abby Melrose. Mark Rose. No, sorry, I read them too closely. Abby Melrose. Mark Rose, Catherine Medew, Todd, and Russell Bennett. Thank you one and all for going to patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod, that's A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod, and supporting us. Okay, on with the show. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
It occurs to me that the exact same qualities that a coach would be looking for in an elite sports star, the qualities of recklessness, bravado, a desire to excel, risk-taking, ability to control fear, they're strikingly similar to the kinds of qualities or the kinds of attributes that you'd see in a good bank robber.
Susanna Lobez and her writing partner, James Morton, have written some of Australia's best-selling true crime books about some of our most feared criminals. Books like Gangland Australia, Gangland Sydney, Gangland Melbourne, and Gangland The Great Escapes. You may be sensing a theme here, but their latest book has some real surprises. Gangland This Unsporting Life features stories at the intersection of what are arguably Australia's two great passions. Crime and sport.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
We started the conversation by asking Susanna about Daniel King, who was shot dead by police outside Sydney's Penrith Police Station in October 2019 after he'd fired several shots into the building. It later emerged he'd also fired shots into the St Mary's Police Station earlier in the evening after firing on his pregnant former partner's home.
Very recently, in early October, this guy who had been a promising player for the Penrith Panthers some years ago, he got injured in some tackle or whatever. So he visited his ex's home. She's pregnant, she says, with his baby. He said not. He's got another woman pregnant somewhere else who apparently is texting with him constantly. And anyway, he's shooting at her house, the ex's house, and she looks very pregnant in the pictures. And then he drove with a shotgun to the two police stations, St Mary's and Penrith, and started firing at the cops. And in fact, I think one of them got some shotgun blast in the top of his head.
Yeah,
not
some shrapnel in the back of the head,
But I mean he was a promising rugby player 10 years ago. Then he got injured. Then he turned to bodybuilding and
rugby league.
Yeah.
So I had no idea he had a sporting background at all. This guy. Obviously I can see a bodybuilding background, but a rugby league background.
Yes, and apparently he got some support from an organisation called the Men of League, which is, I think, a very needed organisation because it helps people reacclimatise back into the non-sport world after their careers come to an end or after they've faced an injury. But this was a sad and sick man, I would say. Most of us have careers. You come, you go, you find another little niche. Yeah. But a lot of these guys, they have nowhere to turn. And a lot of them, too many of them, go down the slippery slope to crime.
I guess very few of them get to go then into coaching and even fewer into media.
Some that do go into coaching, and obviously most want to, or commentating. This fellow, again, early in October, got a job as a Brisbane rugby league coach, and he got caught for sending a series of sexy, lewd messages to one of his junior players. This is a guy called Miller. He pleaded guilty involving grooming a child back in 2018. So he's going to be jailed for a while. He disclosed to this guy he was gay and invited the boy to a hotel room. The same probably happens with girls that some of these guys get involved with later on. But I think their sense of identity is so wrapped up in their ego and their hypermasculinity and their showiness and their recklessness and their fearlessness that sometimes, I mean, after writing 13 books about crime and criminals, do you know, it occurs to me that the exact same qualities that a coach would be looking for in an elite sports star, the qualities of recklessness, bravado, a desire to excel, diligence in training, risk-taking, ability to control fear, they're strikingly similar to the kinds of qualities or the kinds of attributes that you'd see in a good bank robber or a good drug importer, you know, nerves of steel.
Oftentimes we hear about gangsters hanging out with sports people, don't we? Troubled sports stars being friends with crime figures. I've heard a lot of stories about Carl Williams, for example, having mates who were sports stars, and there seems to be a real love affair between the two occupations, if I could call them that.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
A mutual fascination.
Yeah.
It's almost like the lure of the siren song of sport and crime. I reckon the Australian Crime Commission got it right in 2013 when it said it was concerned about increasing associations between professional athletes and organised criminal identities. Because, of course, as sports gambling has become so important in the last few decades, it can corrupt the athlete and also gives a form of social status to the criminal. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the great stories from 2007 was poor old Alan Didak, who I'm certainly not saying was a criminal. He was a respectable sport player.
Former Collingwood great.
He probably didn't even know, Michelle, that he was drinking away in the Spearmint Rhino nightclub in 2007 with this new mate that was buying him drinks and then offered him a lift home in his gorgeous Mercedes. Alan must have had misgivings when his new buddy drove the wrong way and was heading across the Baltic Bridge. He must have had a few more misgivings or pause for thought when the driver, Chris, started shooting a handgun out of the driver's window as he was going across the Baltic Bridge. And when they finally arrived at the Hell's Angels Campbellfield Clubhouse, he must have seriously worried what he got himself into. He couldn't get a taxi or an Uber from the clubhouse.
No, who's coming?
Hello, Hell's Angels.
No, even for Alan Didak, who's a clean skin. Yeah, like, he's got no clean history of any of any drama. But you're right, they're hanging out in similar places in a city like Melbourne or Sydney.
And drinking away. Yeah. And inspired by the gorgeous, glamorous black Mercedes and happy to get a lift and probably a bit shocked when the gun starts being fired. But, he was finally dropped back in the city by this Chris, who is also known to us all as Christopher Wayne Hudson. Mm-hmm. Who was a member of the Finks, then defected to the Hell's Angels, which is never a good thing for your health.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. If I'm Alan Didak, I'm suddenly thinking, I could get shot here.
Yeah.
Like, anything could happen.
Yeah. I don't think the AFL media people would be happy with.
But I think Collingwood did give him a bit of a strong serve and hoped he learned his lesson, and I'm sure he did, because it was only, I mean, Hudson had been involved in that kickboxing tournament stoush between the Finks and the Angels the year before, where people were stabbed and thrashed. And then, of course, a few weeks after the Didak incident, Hudson was the one who was shooting at his girlfriend and shot the innocent bystanders who came to help her.
The Dutch backpacker Brendan Keeler, who was the lovely man who tried, and he got murdered.
So, you know, really, I think that the mutual flirtation between an attraction and the lure of the dangerous life and the dark side. I think that many of these sportsmen, and it is generally sportsmen, find that very alluring. John Elias, who wrote the book called Sin Bin back in 2010, he had grown up as a kind of a juvenile delinquent in a place called Punch Bowl. And he talks about this really openly in his book. He was robbing supermarkets with this Bulldogs gang in Punch Bowl and stealing cars. And he was jailed, I think, on bail in Long Bay on a charge of attempted murder, which he was later acquitted of, let's be clear. But in jail, he got a brilliant university education in crime from the likes of Nettie Smith, Danny Karam, who was the DK's boys gangster, and he became the muscle for hire for all kinds of crime figures and was involved in some very hairy standovers and debt collection. I don't know how he managed the rugby league career as well as the crime career, but he was in the NRL and overseas. And he tells tales about firearms involvement, violent standovers and debt collection, receiving stolen goods, and all the scams and betting fixes in harness racing, you know, trotting at Harold Park. And, I mean, his book's actually a really good read, but he turned over a new leaf and, you know, said, I'm crime-free, and, you know, he had some illness issues and apparently was completely reformed. But he did shoot a betting partner over a bit of a kind of mysterious debt in 2003, served 4.5 years. And then he wrote his book in 2010, but by 2014 he was pleading guilty to intimidation with menaces of a company director down in Melbourne. So, you know, I think he's made efforts to reform, but the sirens call of crime and the underworld and using your muscle. When he was a youngster, still a teenager, he's in Long Bay with Nettie Smith and Danny Karam, who's like a serious, serious gangster. He's getting, you know, brainwashed into this is a great way of life. And it's like the guys, you had the fellow on, was it Mahmood? I heard the podcast and he's been quoted as saying, you know, some of these Lebanese gangs or the Afghani gangs, you know, brothers for life, and they get seduced by the shiny fast cars and the Rolex watches and the seemingly endless supply of women. And when you talk about the ones who were led astray. I mean, I don't know if you guys remember the case of Jimmy Cracker, who was the father of a car player, but he was a...
he was like a North Melbourne legend.
Yeah, he was, and also played for St Kilda with the AFL at one stage. But he really did fall under the spell, the speed-dealing biker, John William Higgs. Apparently Cracker, he invested money in this so-called rock concert scam, which was a rock concert that never happened. And Cracker had probably, you know, given his last dollar to Higgs. And I think it was the way that Higgs was laundering cash because, you know, he was dealing speed. He was one of Australia's biggest speed dealers. And to offer Jimmy a way to recover some of the money, he said, oh, no problem, Jimmy. Listen, we'll get you to just help with this shipment across the Nullarbor in, I don't know, Toyota Corolla or something. And, I mean, even the cops who were prosecuting him said he was really like a bloody glorified delivery boy. He wasn't really the brains behind the operation at all, but he was caught red-handed unloading 5.3 kilos of speed in a Perth garage with another bloke. He copped 16 years for that, and bloody Higgs only got 4 back in Melbourne for being the organiser of the whole thing.
And this just goes to, unfortunately, that cliche of sportsmen being really dumb as well. Doesn't it?
Well,
this
sort easily of... led, maybe, you know?
Yeah, I think he's still, like, when you think about footy players, AFL players who've really had that fall from grace, Jimmy Cracker is still one of the ones you think of. Like, you know, you think of Ben Cousins.
Yeah.
It's bloody tragic. But there was someone in the news recently, wasn't there? Susanna, an AFL player who...
A West Coast Eagles premiership star, former, Daniel Chick, who he was fined early in October, $900, after the police found ice in his car and a glass pipe. And this wasn't his first offence. Apparently it's the second time it's happened this year. And, you know, he was playing in premierships. And
yeah, he's an amazing player.
And now he's got all these drug offences and he's using ice. I mean, for God's sake, if they worship the muscle, if they worship the body, which, as we can tell, a lot of these sports guys do, then to do such ravaging harm to your body as ice can do, you just find it unbelievable.
Well, I don't know. Having never used ice, I don't understand how those two things go together. And yet, if we look at the West Coast Eagles, there was certainly a period of time when
they were drug addled.
They did go together.
Yeah. Yep. Back in the 1920s, I think it was in 1878, that some botanist or doctor in England discovered that coca leaves help relieve anxiety or stress or tiredness.
And then it creates quite a bit of anxiety.
And then they gave them to their runners and their cyclists. And, I mean, in 1920s, you know, cocaine was regularly given to runners.
I guess those kinds of drugs would allow you to train longer and then go home and clean the house and do all sorts of things. It's so
go mad. Dancing.
Yeah. Ben Cousins, have you been able to look into Ben's situation or is it just too sort of ongoing?
It's ongoing and I do, I mean, you know, he's mentioned, of course, in the book. I mean, some of them I really feel sorry for.
And there's Chris Mainwaring as well. He died in 2007. I always think Chris Mainwaring was such a great player, good looking.
Yeah.
They had the world at their feet and he died from too much cocaine, like a seizure brought on by too much cocaine. And Ben Cousins and been with him the weekend. So there was those guys who were, I don't know, invincible and just rock stars in Western Australia. And I always think so sad. I always think of Chris Mainwaring as being one of the tragedies of AFL.
And Ryan Tandy, he was Bulldogs, rugby. He, a poor fella. He overdosed in 2014. Yeah. But he really fell victim to the temptation of sports betting. You know, we know it's all over sport.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when you've got, for instance, in racing, you've got on offer about $427 million in prize money a year, but a $20 billion sports gambling industry, you know, you have to feel that the temptation must be overwhelming.
Anyone who listens to Andrew Rule's podcast as religiously as we do will have learned so much about it because he loves it, the horse racing, and he quite often does some specials. And he did some recently with a jockey mate of his. And I was astounded at the level of it, how easy it is. It seems ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Jockeys working with crime syndicates.
Yes, exactly. And it's been like that for 100 years.
So it seems.
You know, I mean, there's been in the racing world, and there's a lot of chapters in our book about various aspects of racing, all different ways of cheating and nobbling and doping.
And they used to use these electric kind of pod things.
Jiggers,
Jiggers. I learned what they were. There was that recent scandal where a trainer was accused.
Darren Ware, was it?
Yeah, accused of using them.
Everybody knows about the 1980s fine cotton affair where the colour of the horse's leg changed. But that isn't the first time. I mean, in the trots 100 years ago, there'd be a horse and then there'd be a deluge and the ink would start running off the horse and
they
the completely different colour.
Painted horses paint. And then in fine cotton, they went to the chemist and bought henna hair dye, women's hair dye, and put it all on the horse. And then it rained and it was like dripping off and everything. It's so ridiculous.
I know. Couldn't they have had a girlfriend that said, look, this kind of dye isn't permanent. Maybe you should get, you know, don't use this cheap dye. Let's use something permanent. Back in the 70s, there was a guy called Victor Rick Renzella. He was a car salesman, a gambler, a race fixer. And at the Casterton races in 1972, he first of all ran his horse around to reduce its condition, you know, to run it down and alter its handicap. And then he switched the horse Regal Vista for Royal School. And the jockey was heard to say he was going to make $4,000 from the race and the switch, and Renzella was jailed. And his barrister believed that Renzella's downfall came because he couldn't bear to have Regal Vista shot, because that was often the fate of running horses.
Oh, thank God he's got something going for him, this fellow. He didn't want his horse shot at least.
And I think he gave the horse, the good horse, to his barrister, Philip Opas, and he lived for a fine old age. But there was another case, which wasn't exactly a ring-in. It was a weird case of the non-existent horse. And there was a very old lady owner, horse owner, who had a mare called Jag One, and she had the horse with a successful trainer, Michael Day, who she paid thousands of dollars to for the stabling and training. He advised her to put the mare in foal. So she paid over $3,000, another $3,000, for the artificial insemination. God knows it didn't cost that much with my IVF.
I think it's pretty pricey getting your horses inseminated.
Yeah. And now she was told that there had been a foal born. She was so excited. She went down to see this little foal called Miriam and visited the foal in Goulburn and noticed it had some small white spots high on its nose and black hooves with white markings. So over the next few years, she was paying, you know, thousands of dollars in fees and stabling and training, and went back another time to see the horse and was shown what I can only say is a horse of a different colour but than what she'd seen originally. But she was fobbed off and, you know, told, oh, yes, the horse is still training. And then she would say, well, why isn't the horse racing? I want to see Miriam race. And Day was telling her, oh, the horse has been ill or the horse has had injuries or whatever. And finally in 2015, about 6 years later, the lady lost faith and she took her doubts to the police. Day wasn't exactly a clean skin and he pleaded guilty to fraud. His barrister said, oh, look, he just didn't have the heart to tell the old lady that there was no such Miriam. Oh. And he was very...
He had the heart to take her fees.
Yes. Very lucky not to go to jail. He slid under the wire with an intensive corrections order, but, you know, the horse never existed.
And, you know, Susanna, when we were talking about how, you know, sport is still male dominated, but there have been a few women in sport who have fallen foul of the law.
No, I don't believe it.
No, they have.
Donna Marie Parsons.
Yes, Donna Marie. Well, she was a wrestler or a fighter.
She was she fought under the name the Welsh Dragon.
Yeah, she was.
Which is fascinating.
I think she fought in UK and in Europe. And again, I don't quite know what kind of fighting, but she became heavyweight champion of Australia by defeating the only other person in the country that actually fitted into that class. She married a very nice dog breeding, mild mannered English bloke. And then she set up a company called Melbourne Wrestling Promotions. Now, she took out a big insurance policy on her first promotion and then went one step further and hired two hitmen to kill her husband, Paul. She got sentenced to an 18-year minimum. and in jail, fell in love with another husband killer, and who knows whether they're living happily ever after in jail or out.
So she did actually take the hit happened?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God.
The mild-mannered guy. And I don't know, I think she thought maybe the insurance would set her up for life, you know, her life after wrestling, which, of course, they all have to think about. I mean, one of the interesting and curious story about women crims in our book is Madame Isabel Newton, who ran as a sprinter under the name Madame Isabel. She claimed to be Australia's female running champion and called for contenders, and she... In those days, this is in the early 1900s, you know, a lot of people went into running because the prize money, the bags were big. And also there was ways of, you know, nobbling other people and some poor guys at the store gift, you know, had their knees kicked out from under them and, you know, before the finals. But she lost this race in any event. But and I was thinking about it the other night that really she did become one of Australia's very rare female serial killers because she became a baby farmer, in inverted commas. This is in 1908-09 where poor women who were pregnant, you know, they couldn't get abortions, there was no contraception, they were dumped by their blokes, and they would farm their babies out to some woman who had her own kids to care for them for 10 quid a week or a month or whatever.
With the intention that they'd come back and, you know, get when those children on their feet. Yeah, yeah. Later on.
Yeah, so, and sometimes the baby farmer ladies would claim that they would look for adoptive parents, and this was the case with Madame Isabel.
So in the meantime, you're paying still?
Yes.
You're paying this lady?
Yes.
Right.
And she was taken to court in relation to one little baby called Winifred, which seemed to have disappeared. She said she handed over to an adoptive mother in East Melbourne, but, you know, that wasn't proven. Then the police came to her house to arrest her, and she said, I'd like to get changed before I get arrested and taken away. She went into her room and took strychnine, leaving a note for her children and husband. And I've actually seen them at the Victorian Archives, her hand-scrawled notes saying, you know, my husband and children had nothing to do with it. My husband thought I was getting 10 quid a week for the babies. And anyway, she died, obviously before any child could take place, but they did find the bodies of at least three babies around Carron Beach or near Mordialloc and under the hen house at her place. And so, you know, that's a ghastly story. So women athletes aren't immune from the occasional lurch towards crime.
Yeah, I don't think gangsters are going looking for the Firebirds, the netball team.
No. Or the Opals.
Or the Opals, yes.
For some reason, women's sport just doesn't have the allure that men's sport does it? There's something about big male sportsmen and gangsters that attracts each other.
It's like crime and sport have that element of drama. I know I really find that a lot of podcasts about sports have that real element of all the human drama that crime has. It's like, you know, when they talk about the thin blue line with police. My husband was in the police for years, and he said one of the best coppers he ever knew was this guy who'd grown up in the East End, and he knocked about with all the guys who probably he would have been arresting, or like, so he could have gone either way. He could have been a crim or a cop, and he said he was the best copper he'd ever seen on the street.
Well, I don't want to drum the point home too much, but you know, one of the things that you see is sport is still, we have to say, ladies, don't we, that it's dominated by men. I know we're seeing some real heroic activities by the likes of the young athletes in women's football.
Yeah, yep. But absolutely. When it comes to the money side of things and all of those aspects, it's definitely dominated
it's
by men still.
Men. Yeah. And you know, the statistics are from the Bureau of Crime Research and Statistics is that crime is also dominated by men. 97% of homicides and physical attacks, and even more than 50% of shoplifting is done by men. And that surprised me, having been a junior barrister all those years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, crime is not an equal opportunity endeavour.
After the break, Susanna turns her attention to boxing and mixed martial arts. Coming up on Australian True Crime, possibly the worst named yacht in criminal history. But first, Emily started reading Susanna Lopez and James Morton's new book, Gangland, This Unsporting Life, before I did. And one night, she texted me one name. It brought memories flooding back to me of a boxing family from country New South Wales. Their tyrannical father had brought them to Australia after the child welfare unit in their native England had begun investigating him for his cruelty. It must have confirmed for his three sons, his daughter and their stepmother that he was untouchable, above the law, and that there was no use in complaining or trying to fight him. That man's name was Cess Waters.
Yeah, well, this was back in the 80s. Cess Waters had four children, three sons, and the sons went on to be champion Australian boxers. Troy won the Commonwealth titles and really could have gone on to be world champion with the right management, which he didn't have. Guy also did well. And Dean was Australian heavyweight champion back in the 80s. Cess was always in control. I mean, seriously, sadistically in control. I mean, he used to beat all the kids, the daughter included, with a rubber hose often.
He was this tiny little man, wasn't he? I can still picture him. And they had a farm. Did they have a farm?
Remote.
Yes, that's right.
And
shuffling around in his farm, he looked like a sort of grubby little fella with a cap on.
Grubby little vicious brute. And a child abuser. Now, I don't know the fate of the first wife, but there was a second wife, the stepmother to the kids, and she left him. Hard to believe why. Cess was furious and started pressuring Dean, one of the sons, into killing his stepmother and the stepmother's new bloke, a guy called Alan Hall. Dean resisted, obviously, didn't want to kill his stepmother, but was constantly badgered by Cess. And eventually, after some time, he enlisted a friend, Damon Cooper, and although he couldn't bring himself to kill his stepmother, in June 1988, Dean and Cooper got together and shot Alan Hall dead. Now, everything goes quiet from then on in. I don't know what the kind of investigation there was or prosecution of anyone, but in the late 90s, so nearly 10 years later, Dean could obviously no longer live with himself, with his conscience, and gave himself up, dobbing in both his dad and his mate Cooper. All three were prosecuted in separate trials. But the jury heard from psychiatrists that Dean's will had been, as the law says, overborne by his father's. He was so dominated by this man that the jury acquitted him in 20 minutes, just because he'd been so, he had no will of his own anymore. Cooper got 12 years minimum for manslaughter, and Cess, we're all waiting with bated breath to hear what happened to Cess. He died just before his trial was going to go on. So there was no justice there, really. Cess was the bad man of the picture.
Troy was one of the other brothers, and he tragically died last year. He had leukemia, and he seemed to sort of avoid a lot of the
publicity involved. I mean, you just don't know how family like that would ever get through life, you know. That's so traumatized would they be. One of the recent trends, I mean, boxing and wrestling has always been up for the fix because, you know, people take a dive or they have the fights fixed. And, I mean, that was going on way back in history in Australia, in Kalgoorlie, in Coolgardie, where they used to have those boxing matches where it was always fixed or they'd cut the lights out at the certain time. Or they used to use guys that were punch drunk, you know, like their brains were rattling in their head after being punched so often, and they'd be pushed into the arena again by the likes of John Wren or Ruth Naylor or some of these fight fixers and stadium owners. And then eventually they said, oh, well, you've got to have a doctor, you've got to have a head x-ray before you're allowed to go in the ring. So they have brought in precautions over the years. But, I mean, the latest thing is mixed martial arts and Ultimate Fight Fighting Championship.
That's quite incredible. I've watched some of that and it's like, part of me is like, this is awful. And then the other half is, these people are incredible athletes.
It's been really controversial in Australia recently because state by state, they've been deciding whether or not to allow it and support it. Is there a criminal element to?
Well, it's still up and coming.
Yeah.
But it's looking like it's going to be the next sort of multi-million dollar sport, and it's got its fair share of thugs and convicted crims. But there was one bloke who, he didn't have a parallel career in crime and sport. He had the crime career first and then the sport career. This is a guy called Rodney Goldie Atkinson, And he was named for his diamond and 24-carat gold teeth.
Oh, he had the grills.
Worked for one of the Ibrahim brothers, not John the clean skin, but one of the other brothers, Fadi. And he also did a lot of underworld kind of heavy work for the likes of Bassam Hamzi, who I think we've talked about before, of the most serious criminals in Australia.
So this was before the sporting career.
Yeah, so he was, doing the dirty work for these guys, and he was quoted as saying, "Oh, it was absolute shit, one bloke sits there getting rich and the rest of us are just trudging along as soldiers."
He put it on him, so he's a smart guy.
He's a brothers for life.
But he ended up for 5 years for firearms. He was very lucky not to get done for conspiracy to murder. In jail, he converted to Islam, which is happening a lot, as your mate Fazal says. Also evidently did a lot of muscle work in jail, probably got some tats, we all see them.
Yeah.
But on his release, not so long ago, he became an MMA UFC fighter, won 13 fights, so obviously not too shabby.
Yeah.
But he did have links with biker gangs, and he also rejoined the Brothers for Life group, which he'd sort of disavowed while he was in prison, and was arrested in 2017 and jailed again for drugs. Now, in jail, he hasn't heaped glory on himself either. I mean, he did stomp on the head of the granny killer, and then he assaulted another inmate, and so he's, I think, in a bit of a cycle of staying in jail and considered pretty damn dangerous. But again, did the crime first, then rehabilitated himself to become a martial artist, and then unfortunately got tempted back into crime.
Yeah, I see that Mahmoud Fazal, who we've spoken about and who, was a guest, he wrote for Vice about the resurrection of that gang, Brothers for Life.
Yes.
So they must have gone be quiet for a while on their back. The lure must be very strong, I think, when you're,
But unfortunately Goldie's not done anything for the sport, for the reputation of the sport, so there'll be other blokes in the sport going, Goldie.
Yeah, what did you do then?
Because you have to be super disciplined to be an MMA fighter.
But, the training and the commitment is, I guess, the hallmark of any serious professional athlete.
That's true.
And, there's been many sad cases. Back in the early 80s and even late 70s, and this is when footballers used to have day jobs, there was a guy called Fred Cook in Port Melbourne, and I couldn't believe it when I read he kicked nearly 1,300 goals, but he was once offered $1,000 to play below par, as it were, in other words, to drop a game. But after his footy career, again, we're talking about the tragic aftermath of a successful playing career, he turned to drugs and to trafficking and to crime to support his drug habit. And look, he copped a very understanding and sympathetic judge and got a 4-year bond, but, later breached the bond. And the judge was so kind of kind and merciful. He said, this is a real example of a sporting hero who's fallen on tragedy. So he was cut a bit of slack, you might say.
He was a rock star of the VFL back in the day for Williamstown, and he owned a pub that was frequented by the Pettingills, I'm pretty sure. So they would drink there, and it's sort of, got all messy.
Always going to get messy. What, do you know what happened to him?
Still alive. Lives, hard scrabble life. What would be your favourite case from this book, do you think?
John Nikolic was a horse trainer with his wife Yvette, owned a number of horses, including a horse called, I think, Wonderful Jester, who, there was a few disqualifications going on, a few dodgy doings at the diggings. And he had some form for performance-enhancing substances and special treatments for his horses. And so he had, a few disqualifications, but nothing really to upset his glamorous and exciting lifestyle. In 2018, he and his wife Yvette took off on their catamaran, which was called, perhaps appropriately, Shenanigans. And
it's a great word.
I know, they went off to enjoy that. I mean, it's almost
self-inculpatory,
isn't
it? It's so cheeky. It is a great word, but it's very cheeky. And again, if you're a colourful racing identity,
do you want to call your boat that?
I'd call it Nothing Going On Here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Look away.
In excess is bliss.
Right now. Just on the boat with the missus.
So they were off, living the high life in around South America, across the Pacific. Yeah. Now, in June, you might remember, they dropped anchor in Nadi in Fiji.
Yes.
And they got a bit of a surprise visit from the Fiji customs officers. And John apparently, in the moment, swallowed a cocktail of liquid cocaine and speed, which resulted in him being rushed to intensive care hospital. While customs searched, they found 13 bricks of coke and methamphetamines. I mean, there was like $20 million worth of drugs found.
Quite the shenanigans.
Plus guns.
Whoa.
Plus ammo. And while John was rushed off for his overdose, the pair were in court earlier this year. And rather surprisingly, Yvette was acquitted of everything. The judge found there was only circumstantial evidence. And she was saying how she was missing her children who were, you know, far away from her in Queensland. And anyway, poor old John, who had swallowed some of the evidence, ultimately copped all the blame and was sentenced to 16 years. Now, there was some talk about an appeal against Yvette's release, but I haven't heard anything further after that.
God.
So, you know, like, what not to do when you're, as you say, colourful identity, how not to bring attention to yourself.
Yeah. I wonder why he swallowed that stuff. Like, what is the point of swallowing?
Getting rid of evidence?
Yeah, but you couldn't swallow all those blocks of meth.
No.
Why oh, my God, would you bother?
Well, and I've never even heard of liquid cocaine, to be frank.
I don't think I have either. I was just thinking of, we just did the Diane Brimble story, but that was liquid ecstasy.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's, extraordinary shenanigans. And for her to get away with...
Yeah, released, released. You know, I mean, she was just on the right side of the judge that day.
Yeah, I saw something in March reported by AAP that Fiji prosecutors were going to appeal the acquittal.
I haven't seen any updates since then. And, you know, I mean, that's the matter for them, obviously, you know.
Your wife was a registered owner of the vessel. She was with you on board.
Yeah.
Oh, but he's, John claimed sole responsibility.
Okay. Isn't there something when you're a husband and wife with in court? You're a barrister, Susanna.
Well, you know, it would be very convenient for one person to take all the blame. Yeah. You know, the noble cause. I still think that there would be an arguable case for an appeal in that situation. But, you know, it's at the discretion of the prosecution.
Because apparently the Fijian authorities are going to sell that yacht because it's a proceed of crime.
Yeah.
So shenanigans, the Fiji Revenue and Customs Service can probably sell it. Because I guess, anything, houses, boats, cars.
Yeah, I wonder what they'll get. I mean, Victor Pierce, we've spoken about him before, and he used to apparently tell his wife, we have her hearsay, that he used to get an erection when he ran into a bank to do a robbery. You know, so it's like a thrill.
Jeez.
It's a thrill. Bet you're glad I shared that.
So the visuals I'm getting right now. But actually what I'm thinking about is the sports people who say the same thing. Mm. I've heard sports people saying the same thing. Arnold Schwarzenegger famously in the documentary, I think Mr. Universe, he's very young, and he's talking about, when I'm lifting, I'm calming. It's like I'm calming. It's
oh
a famous because it's so
calming
ridiculous.
Or,
no, calming. Because his accent's so
which is
so
also
thick.
Calming.
Yeah.
That's Susanna Lobez, who, with her writing partner James Morton, has released a new book called Gangland, This Unsporting Life. It's available now from the bookshop on our website, AustralianTrueCrimePodcast.com. Thank you for downloading this episode. We'll be back next week.